Cuba's rising dissent, climate change and building safety, and the college athletes can now bank on their names. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thousands of Cubans on the communist island took to the streets in ongoing protests. We're going to get an update on what's happening and whether those protests could lead to change in political leadership. Also, there's still a lot to learn about the collapse of the Surfside condo. What role could climate change and sea level rise play in the safety of our buildings that sit on the water?
Being a college football fan my whole life, right? It's finally here. I would never thought that this moment would come when I'm in college.
Finally, college athletes can now make money while still in school. We're going to meet a UM player who didn't wait long to start cashing in. All of that today on Sundial after the news. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute. Hello and welcome to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for joining us. Thousands of Cubans took to the streets yesterday to protest against the country's communist regime, the largest protest in decades. Demonstrators shouted liberty and enough among anti-government slogans in Havana and other towns and cities. The people expressed their discontent over the food shortages, high prices, and how officials have handled the pandemic. The Cuban government sent in police to quell protest. President Miguel Díaz-Canel blames the dissent on the U.S. economic embargo. WLRN's America's correspondent Tim Padgett joins us now. Also joining us, Andy Gomez. He's a retired professor of Cuban studies and dean of international studies at the University of Miami. He also is the author of Social Challenges Facing Cuba. Gentlemen, I appreciate the time. Tim, I want to start with you. Paint a picture for me here. What's the scene on the streets right now?
It's hard to say, as I was saying, because at the moment we're having a hard time determining what's going on the island, because last night, as you know, the Cuban government shut down the internet. And so that's made it very difficult to see what's going on either on social media or in direct contact with many of the people that we usually talk to there on the island. I have not been able to communicate with anyone on the island since late last night, either on WhatsApp or any other platform. And so we're really not sure if those massive protests that we saw yesterday are continuing on into to today.
Yeah. Andy, you had some luck. You did actually speak with some folks on the ground this morning. What are you hearing?
Well, not only did I speak with some folks on the ground, but I also spoke with some members of the Cuban government that are retired. And I'll get to that in a minute. The people that I got through today said that the repression, as Tim pointed out, that started yesterday has gotten worse. With no stopping. Many people have been taken to jail. Others have been beaten severely. And it doesn't surprise me, because the repression apparatus of the Cuban government has demonstrated throughout the year has been like none that we have seen in the Western Hemisphere.
And Tim, some of the images that we did see, they were all coming from social media, live streams on Facebook, and then suddenly everything was gone. All those videos were gone.
Right. We are seeing, as I said, a trickling of them. We're seeing things like, for example, a list that just came out on social media from dissident groups there in Cuba that I'm looking at, about more than a dozen names of people. Either they're calling them desaparecidos, meaning disappeared, or they're missing, or they've been just out of the blue detained, you know, plucked off the street. And so we are seeing, you know, things like that, but nothing like the flow of social media images that we saw yesterday on Twitter and WhatsApp and Facebook that showed us just how unprecedented these protests were. I mean, if you would ask me if I've ever seen, you know, police cars or anything of that nature being overturned on the streets of Havana during the protest in my lifetime, I would have told you no. I didn't think that could happen. But these, as you pointed out earlier, we haven't seen protests like this in Cuba probably since 1959, when the Cuban Revolution itself took over.
And right now, the different forms of communication, whether it's WhatsApp or Facebook, are those still actually open and working, or have they found a way to shut those down?
Oh, they have found a way to shut those down. And as I said, they shut those down last night. I have not been able to communicate. I communicate most regularly with people in Cuba by WhatsApp. I have not been able to get through to anybody on that platform today. And even we're hearing, I did speak with someone who did get through to some people today, but they're hearing that even landline connections, if you are known as a dissident, for example, your landline is being compromised right now.
Andy, you said you spoke with some former government officials?
Yeah, I can't reveal the name, but these are individuals that I have stayed in touch, even though we have, of course, tremendous difference of opinion on what Cuba should be and go from. But in the last, my last communication with a very former high-ranking member of the Cuban government, he told me that the government was extremely concerned, and quote unquote, these were grave moments for the government if they were not able to shut down the protests that we saw yesterday in the streets of Cuba.
Talking about the last time we saw anything like this happen in Cuba, Andy, isn't it maybe the last time was 1994 when you saw the uprising, the Malecónazo uprising?
I don't think that even compares to it. I would say that what we saw yesterday, and I don't know if Tim would agree with me, I dare to say I agree with Tim. I don't think we've seen this since 1959. The Malecónazo in the 90s was mostly in Havana, and that was squelched very quickly by Fidel Castro. So the numbers that we saw yesterday on the streets was quite spectacular. Now, the issue is, are the Cubans going to be able to sustain protesting in the streets? Like, for instance, we saw in Venezuela for weeks and months. I do not think so, because of the repression machine and the high price that they will pay for continuing to protest.
So Tim, the protest, is it different because, how is the protest different from, you know, the social movements that we've seen in Cuba in the past? Is it about the scope or the nature of what they're protesting?
The scope. And not only the scope, but what a Cuban mentioned to me last night, the fact that the internet, which was, you know, introduced more fully to Cubans, you know, a few years ago, the internet has created what she called a culture of accountability, finally, in Cuba, where Cubans now have a channel to vent their frustrations that they never had before, whether it's Twitter, whether it's WhatsApp, Facebook, etc. Take yesterday morning. I mean, where all of this sort of began was perhaps not even in Havana. It might have been in smaller towns like San Antonio de los Baños, where people are just so fed up with the electricity outages and the lack of food and the fact that the government has not done enough to get vaccinations out to the people. So they're seeing these spikes in COVID cases and deaths. And that, I think my impression is that the protests really started in places like that. And because of social media, they were able to then show the rest of Cubans on the island what they were doing. And then suddenly you started seeing protests spark in places like Santiago out in the east and in Havana. And so I think that's what's made the scope of these protests larger, but also the fact that Cubans were seeing them more emboldened to get out on the streets and protest like this in ways we never have before.
And I mean, look, they're sitting there screaming liberty and enough. Is it about a change in government, or is it just, hey, prices are too high, we can't get food, we can't get vaccines?
I think in the end it does have to be about regime change, because I think they've come to the conclusion that the only way they're going to see these problems solved is if, as they were saying yesterday, away with the dictatorship. I mean, that was one of the slogans that was being chanted yesterday. So I think they've arrived at the conclusion that until they see more democratic governance on their island, they're not going to get these god-awful economic problems solved.
Andy, I mean, what is the government doing about the discontent in general? When you talk about government, I mean, the economy, the prices, and again, the vaccines, what have they said about it?
Well, they made it very clear today. Their foreign minister, Bruno Rodriguez, blamed the United States, and Miguel Díaz-Canel, Cuba's president, blamed the U.S. Economic embargo for all the problems in Cuba. These two gentlemen and the rest of the Cuban government need to understand that the majority of the Cuban people, if not all of them, don't no longer believe that propaganda. They realize that the majority of the problems have been created from within the island. As a matter of fact, I'm just getting a text right now from Rosa Maria Payá, Oswaldo Payá's daughter, who's telling me that the Cuban people have called for a general strike across the entire island beginning today.
Hmm. Again, I'm talking with Andy Gomez, retired professor of Cuban studies at the University of Miami, and WLRN's America's correspondent, Tim Padgett. Protests erupted in Cuba yesterday. The large anti-government demonstrations are something the island has not seen in decades. Videos of the protests were being broadcast on Facebook Live yesterday. That is until the government shut down internet service. You can find more information, by the way, on this story on our social media at WLRN Sundial. Andy, what's different about Díaz-Canel's response from what we used to hear from the Castro regime?
Oh, that's a very good question. You know, when I watched him yesterday come on, first and foremost, he needed to show that the government was in complete control, which is the key issue for them. But unlike Fidel or unlike Raul, I felt that he was a bit agitated, which is not the normal way that Fidel or Raul would have handled things. Even though Raul is retired, there's no question that since yesterday, Raul has been playing a very heavy hand on the decisions being made in Cuba on how to cause this repression. But I want to go back to a point that my good friend and colleague Tim just brought up. And I differ a little bit with Tim, and he knows I do. This is far away from calling for a democracy, because I do think that what we saw yesterday is a call for change. But I don't think that that change has a clear definition. And let me be specific. Cuba has lacked a democratic, stable government, I dare to say, way before 1959. So the organizations, the institutions, the pillars of democracy have been absent in most of the history of Cuba. So, and then on top of that, I think we have learned by trial and error that exporting American democratic principles abroad don't work. And certainly it will not work in Cuba. As much as a Cuban myself, born in Cuba, would like to see a free and democratic government, I think if the government was to fall tomorrow, democracy is very far away still.
Well, that's and another conversation for another day. That's a big, big topic there. Tim, I wanted to get to this point. We've seen an uptick in people fleeing the island. I mean, the New York Times reports that the U.S. Coast Guard has intercepted 512 Cubans since October of 2020, compared to 49 the year before that. Is that an indicator of how bad things are on the island? What does that tell us?
Oh, definitely. And Andy and I were just talking about this before the show, about how back in 1994, the Malacanazo that you brought up, one of the ways that Fidel dealt with that situation then was to say to Cubans, well, okay, great, you don't like it here? Get on your raft and go to the United States. And that's why we saw all those thousands of people in the summer of 1994 get on rafts, these ingeniously crafted rafts, and try to come to the United States. What's different here is we're having these protests, but I don't think the current president, Díaz-Canel, can create a rafters crisis, because the rafters crisis is already here, indicated by the statistics that you just pointed out here. So that shows you how desperate things economically have gotten on the island, that we've already had this deluge of rafters coming to Florida even before these massive protests started.
Andy, the Biden administration issued a statement in response to the protests, saying that they, quote, stand with the Cuban people and they condemn the violence. How far do we expect the administration to go beyond just, you know, vocalizing support?
Well, I think Cuba expected the Biden administration, as soon as they took power, to go back to the Obama policies. And it was very clear that was not the intention. The Biden administration has been, as they have stated repeatedly, reviewing U.S.-Cuba policy, their approach has been based on respect for human rights. And at the same time, they are trying to take away this conflict that has existed between Havana, Washington, D.C., with Miami somewhere in the middle, by trying to approach U.S.-Cuba policy from a multilateral point of view. However, having said that, if I were the Biden administration right now, if they were to ask me, I would suggest the following. For humanitarian reasons, given what we saw on the island yesterday, I would lift and permit remittances to begin to flow into the island immediately. And I would offer Cuba, as we saw last week being offered and given to Latin American countries, many of our vaccines to combat the COVID crisis in Cuba, which, by the way, they will turn down. But at least I like to put Cuba in that defensive posture.
Tim, people around the world and here in South Florida are watching these protests anxiously. You recently spoke with Miami playwright Carmen Palayas.
The Cuban people are fed up. COVID has accelerated the frustration. And thanks to the internet that we got down there several years ago, people are able to communicate. And the myth of the Cuban Revolution is being dismantled one Instagram post at a time.
You mentioned this, Tim, not too long ago. And I'm wondering, you know, the current president, Miguel Díaz-Canel, took office 3 years ago and allowed for more access to the internet. How is that changed things on the island, that newfound access?
Well, this, again, this is just a continuation of what we've been seeing since the internet did become more accessible. In fact, just after the internet became more accessible in Cuba, we saw similar kinds of not to this kind of degree, but still sort of unprecedented kinds of street protests that had to do exactly with the internet. They got the internet and then they said, wait a minute, it's too expensive. So they put out this hashtag, you know, lower the price of the internet for us. And they created protests. Then after that, we saw the artists protest last year demanding free speech. I think what we're seeing is, since the internet has been introduced on the island, we're seeing an evolution of more emboldened protests on the part of Cuban people in the streets. And that's precisely what I think we saw yesterday.
And you're seeing that and hearing that on the island. What about the Cuban American diaspora? What are you hearing about from them here?
Well, the reaction here to anything of this nature on the island is, unfortunately, the tendency is to get a little too much of an adrenaline-filled hope that this is the moment. And I think they would be wise here in the Cuban diaspora to learn from the Venezuelan experience of the past 2 years that, no, it's not, quote, the moment. It takes a while. And you have to be patient, and we have to keep looking at ways to help this phenomenon keep building on itself in Cuba. But I agree with Andy that I don't think this is, quote, the moment. We're not going to see, you know, the regime fall tonight because of this.
Andy, you don't think it's going to be a shift towards democracy? But how much of a threat are these protests to the Cuban government?
There's no question about it. It is a threat, particularly internally, because the question that Raul Castro has started to, I'm sure, think about, and many of the military leadership at top, is, can Miguel Díaz-Canel and the other so-called civilians around them be able to control and move forward? We'll have to wait and see. Now, going back, you know, even before the internet was introduced in Cuba, when the Soviet Union fell, Cubans in the government and in academia started to write and talk about one of the biggest threats that Cuba was going to face moving forward. And I'm talking about 1991. One of the biggest threats that Cuba was going to face moving forward was the loss of the ideology, Marxist ideology, which I think, and Tim is completely correct, and I witnessed this in some of my trips to Cuba, that ideology is no longer in place. As a matter of fact, when Raul Castro took over, we started to see a change in the language from communism to an advanced socialist state, which I'm not sure what that means. Yesterday, for the first time in a long time, I heard Miguel Díaz-Canel call on Cuba's communists to take to the street and help bring down those protesters against the government. So I have to believe that almost after 63 years, and keep in mind, many of the leadership, even within the Cuban armed forces, did not participate in the early days of the revolution. So I have to believe that there is differences of opinion within the political structure of the Cuban government.
Very interesting to see how things play out in Cuba. And as you said, you're talking about, you know, a different generation that doesn't have that connection to the past and how they view the current situation and the future. I want to thank Andy Gomez, retired professor of Cuban studies and dean of international studies at the University of Miami. He's also a retired senior fellow in Cuban studies at UM. And we also heard from WLRN's Latin America correspondent, Tim Padgett. Tim, Andy, thank you so much. I appreciate it.
Thank you. My pleasure.
Well, still to come, climate change, sea level rise, and the Surfside tragedy. How could our environment be impacting building safety? Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. 94 victims have now been recovered from the Surfside tragedy, with 22 potentially still unaccounted for. Search and recovery teams continue their work today after several teams from across the U.S. and the globe headed home over the weekend. Investigators remain on site at the Champlain South Tower, examining what engineering flaws may have led to the building collapse. Many are questioning whether rising seas or a warming climate may have also contributed to the building's instability. WLRN's environment reporter Jenny Stiletovich has been looking into this story, and she joins us now. Jenny, I want to start with a trip back in time. Let's go back to the 1980s when the Champlain Tower was built. How was climate change viewed? Did they think about climate change and sea level rise in affecting buildings back then?
Yeah, and just before I start, I do want to reiterate that the investigation is still very, very early on. And the engineers, geologists I've talked to have said, you know, it may turn out that climate change and the impacts from climate change played no role, you know, absolutely no role in, right, in the building collapse. So I just think we need to establish that this is still in the very, very early stages of the investigation. But to answer your question, you know, back in the 1980s, climate change was something that was, you know, talked about in academia, but it was in the cloistered halls of academia. It was, as one of the geologists told me, it was sort of a siloed conversation. And I mean, you could think of it this way: the International Panel on Climate Change, which is, you know, the influential panel, the IPCC, wasn't even created or convened until 1988 and didn't even issue its first report until 1990.
So a study from 2020 revealed that the building had sunk, that the Champlain Tower had sunk by about half an inch between 1993 and 1996. However, the geologists you talked to say that may not have played a role in the collapse at all. Why?
Well, first of all, they said it's such a small amount in that, you know, the ground rises and falls, it subsides and rises a lot. And engineers try and account for that with their foundations. Like down here, you'll see when a building goes up downtown, these, you know, two-story deep holes are dug so that they can sink foundations down to the bedrock. And also to give you an idea of subsidence, in 1924, the University of Florida sunk a concrete piling into the muck south of Lake Okeechobee to measure the subsidence after they started draining the fields there for farming. And it sunk more than 6 feet. So it's kind of it can happen naturally, and we can also cause it to happen.
And that's interesting. You talk about, you know, they sink foundations into the bedrock limestone to support, to counteract the sinking. But what's unique about Miami limestone that makes the process maybe different from when you're creating a foundation anywhere else, I guess, in Florida or around the country?
Well, you know, so up north they have granite. Here we have limestone. We often see it and think of sinkholes and how crumbly it is. But a geologist, Jack Meter, told me that when you get down to the bedrock limestone here, that it's strong enough and capable of holding up these tall buildings. The sinkholes that you see, the larger ones happen in North Florida, where there are sort of bigger caverns underground. Meter gave me an example. He worked on the Fort Myers Airport before it opened in the 1980s. A 90-foot sinkhole opened up because they had drained the surrounding wetlands to make way for the runway. And when you lowered the water, the caverns collapsed. But he says the sinkholes we have down here are very small, like, you know, just a meter across or so. So they're not, he does not think that if the caverns that we have, if they were to collapse, are even big enough to cause this. But again, you know, these are things that they're going to be looking at, and no one's for sure yet.
Right. Now, that 2020 study, again, looking at the, you know, the possibility of the building sinking even a little bit, but they're also looking at other things too, like what?
So one of the big elements is the salt air and the flooding, the sea spray. That salt air can get into porous concrete and corrode the metal that's used to strengthen the concrete. It's not just sinking. It's we have more rainfall, more flooding. We have low-lying areas that are always underwater now, whether it be, you know, whether the water table is higher. So it's whether it's fresh water or salt water. And whether it's fresh water or salt water makes a difference, because those are different environments that can affect the metal differently, or the concrete, or the materials that are used in buildings. I talked to a materials engineer at the University of Virginia who worked on the Space Shuttle Columbia explosion. And he said, you know, they can model out the strength of these materials. He's a metals guy, but when we're talking about the space shuttle, or he's worked on nuclear reactors and submarines, that the testing they do is a lot more rigorous because they're in much harsher environments. But one of the things they'll look at is, you know, we now live, as the one geologist described it, as a more hostile environment because it's wetter, saltier, rainier. Is that more hostile environment corroding these materials maybe at a faster rate or affecting them differently? It's, you know, so those are some of the things that they'll be looking at.
I mean, so he's talking about like submarines and nuclear reactors, but, you know, talking about that idea of corrosion on a building, I mean, are there any examples that you found about the potential causes of corrosion on a building like that, on the metals used in that kind of construction?
Well, we know that, like I said, the chloride, the salt can penetrate the concrete, and then it causes the steel to rust. And some of these steels are coated in different ways, or something called, I'm going to get technical, but cathodic coating, which is, it's another metal wrapped around the steel that's considered the sacrificial metal. There's this, John Scully, who I talked to at UVA, said there's a process where hydrogen can get in because of that coating and affect the metal differently. So it's not just salt. There are other things, you know, the different metals, the different materials are vulnerable to different things. And trying to unravel what those vulnerabilities are and the time scale at which they happen, so we can determine how long these materials might last in our environment, will be something that they're going to try and unravel.
I'm talking with WLRN's environment reporter Jenny Stiletovich. We are exploring the threats climate change and sea level rise could pose to building safety. And again, as she pointed out, there's a lot to this investigation. So this is just a question right now at this moment. You could read Jenny's story on our social media, by the way, at WLRN Sundial. Jenny, how about sea level rise? I mean, you think about, we build right there on the water. We like to be as close as possible. But, you know, when you look at those buildings right on the coast, what do we know about sea level rise and how that may impact the foundations of a building or just the building itself?
Well, again, so sea level rise means that areas that, you know, that presumably they're built on the ocean, engineers are going to design for storms, they're going to design for storm surge and things like that. But when these buildings were built, you know, we were in a time of of a slow hurricane seasons. It didn't pick up until the 1992. So we've been in this very active period for, you know, since the 90s, where storm surge is higher, you know, flooding happens more frequently. So you get, would that cause, presumably that would be harsher, you know, so that would cause corrosion to be worse. And that's the kind of thing that sea rise, you know, sea rise also affects the soil. One of the geologists told me, you know, you get soil that's dried out, you know, like the peat below the lake. The ground level, how it's saturated can affect the composition of the soil. Things like chemistry, you know, it's physics. I mean, there's a whole lot of processes happen. And we should probably get an engineer on the show or a geologist on the show to better explain it.
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. It's not just about water rising. It's all the different things that come with it. Now, you've talked to a lot of geologists, one in particular, Randy Parkinson. This is him talking about the future of building safety.
This could easily have been something that has nothing to do with climate change. It's building specific. And of course, most, probably 99% of the buildings that have been built that people live in from the 80s forward here are very well designed and very, very reliable and safe. But as the climate changes, the context in which we consider and evaluate safety has to change.
You know, Jenny, I mean, the city, the county, and the region is trying to prepare itself for the future and what sea level rise is going to be and flooding is going to be. And so there are all these conversations about whether it's walls or pumps or whatever it's going to be to protect the city, the region from that. But since this collapse, have there been conversations about, you know, the stability of our buildings and the way we've constructed on the water?
Well, I think what Parkinson was talking about is like looking into the future. It's not just how the buildings are designed and constructed, but whether it's a place where we want to put them. I mean, if we're putting ourselves in a place that's so hostile, is that really wise urban planning? There have been these conversations have been going on, mainly because we're talking about flooding and the health and safety of just humans. I think with this building collapse, it's kind of put it in a new context. And again, I say that, but no one is saying for sure that increased sea levels had anything to do with the collapse. But it just, he's saying it is an important conversation to have and we should have been having. And with this horrible disaster, it is something that we really can't ignore.
You know, after Hurricane Andrew, we saw policy changes to building design to protect against stronger storms. But I know it's early, but I mean, what are the discussions about changes suggested by engineers and geologists since this collapse? And because this is something, as you said, we got to think about this now.
I mean, I think it's going to take the investigation to see what caused it before they can come up with recommendations. And when I was working on this story, I didn't realize this, that, you know, after the Twin Towers and the Alfred P. Murrah explosions, those attacks, they learned something about progressive building collapse. That's something that they think happened at Surfside. So they came up with engineering changes so that buildings would be better protected from progressive collapse. Before those events, they just designed for a single failure and a sudden collapse, not this kind of progressive thing.
And briefly, just what is progressive collapse?
Where there's a failure in one place and you see the building start to fall and then it pulls down the rest of the building.
I see.
Now there are design features so that if part of the building fails, it doesn't pull down the rest of the building.
There are a lot of questions, and as you keep pointing out, there's an investigation. It may take some time. We'll have to sit and wait until we get those answers. WLRN Environment reporter Jenny Stiletovich. Jenny, always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you, Lewis.
And you can read more of her reporting about the connections between sea level rise, climate change, and building safety. Just go to our social media at WLRN Sundial. Well, still to come, college athletes in Florida can now get paid for their brand. We're going to meet one of the first players to strike a deal. Welcome back to Sundial on WLRN. I'm Luis Hernandez. Collegiate athletes in Florida can now make money off their name, image, and likeness. For decades, athletes and their families have fought for compensation as big schools like the University of Florida and Florida State made millions of dollars from their athletic programs. Under a Florida law that began July 1st, student athletes can now sign business agreements that do not violate the standards set by their individual schools. University of Miami quarterback D'Eriq King was among the first to secure one of these contracts, and he's in the process of pursuing many more. He started the company Dreamfield, which sets players up with autograph signings, fan appearances, and more. We spoke with King last week.
I don't think I was just out there, you know, looking for a lot of stuff. A lot of companies came to me, like through social media or, you know, got in touch with me some kind of way and was actually worked with me. And so when July 1st came, obviously I couldn't agree to anything before July 1st. So I waited and waited until, you know, July 1st, 12 o'clock came and a bunch of people hit me up. And I just decided to, you know, go with a company that I was kind of familiar with and, you know, doing research on the company. That was the first company I decided to sign with.
You know, I think about this story over many years covering sports and the challenges that college athletes go through. How significant is this extra money for players in supporting your family, dealing with the stresses of school? You know, it's not just a little extra pocket money. Some of you could make a lot of money.
Yeah, I think it's huge. You know, obviously everybody comes from different backgrounds. So some people need it more than others. But I think just being able to make money off our name, I think, first of all, I think it's very important just to be able to do that, right? And and like you said, some of us making a lot of money, some of us making very little money. But I think if it's, you know, equally amongst teammates, my teammates, and everybody has the same opportunity, it could be a really good thing for the university as well. And I think it's just a great opportunity for us to capitalize on this name, image, and likeness.
What about for you personally? What does it mean for you to be able to make these kind of deals and now be able to be paid for your name, for the King name?
It means a lot. You know, just being a college football fan my whole life, right? Playing college football for the past, you know, years, long time. It's finally here. I would never thought that this moment would come when I'm in college. So I just want to take advantage of it. You know, it means a lot to me just to have, you know, a little bit of extra, you know, pocket change so I can go out there and, you know, have a nice dinner every now and then. That's the biggest thing for me.
You know, I'm wondering, who's working the deals? Is it you? Do you have, like, family helping out? Is it an agent?
Well, I didn't sign to any agency, but I have a good marketing team behind me, Dusty and Zach, and also my family. My family's is helping me a lot, you know, just keeping me, just making sure I do the right things and take the right deals and that. So I have a little team behind me.
And one of the deals that you signed up for the NIL platform Dreamfield. And my understanding is they help book live events like autograph signings, meets and greets. What type of commitment are you looking at with that arrangement? How many meet and greets can you do?
Well, it's that's the thing. It's totally up to the player. So it's not like Dreamfield is, you know, you have to be here, you have to be there. No, it's whatever we want to do. And actually, me and Mackenzie Milton are both co-founders in the company. So we wanted to make sure that, you know, it was the best for the athlete. We didn't want to take any time for meetings, practice, you know, film, study, games. So that's why each individual athlete can set their own rate. So you can, if you want $100 an hour, you can say that. If you want to go do a live booking, you can literally do whatever you want. There's no pressure. It's nothing that you have to do. So that's the biggest thing for us that we wanted to make.
You know, one of the things I keep thinking about, D'Eriq, is the fact that in the past, you guys as athletes had to be so careful. You were walking on eggshells. If anybody even loaned you a couple bucks, the NCAA could come down on you. And now you're telling me, no, man, I could set up as many, you know, meet and greets as I want, and I could do this and I could do that. That has to be a big weight off your shoulders.
Yeah, absolutely. You know, college football in the past was, like you said, you had to walk on eggshells a little bit. You couldn't even, you know, take a free meal if somebody recognized you at a restaurant. You couldn't even, you know, post things on your social media. If you wanted to get a job, you had to go ask a client before you can get a job. So I think the NCAA kind of, you know, obviously, you know, getting a free education, that's a big deal for everybody. We appreciate that. But at the same time, I think it kind of handicapped you because you couldn't get a job. So it's like you play football for 4 or 5 years or whatever sport you play 4 or 5 years, then it's like, hey, go find a job. So I think now just being able to work with companies, kind of learning business a little bit, it will help us in the long run.
My understanding is that you're getting your own NFT later this month. That's a non-fungible token that fans can buy. Do you have any more details about when that's going to be released and what's going to look like?
We're still working on the image right now, but I think we're trying to release it late July. So that's the date, and I think we're going to release a couple NFTs. I think it'll be 30 in total, and I think we'll do it like in waves. So we'll probably release 5 at a time or 3 at a time or however you want to do it, because obviously, you know, I want to save some for the seasons, for after those big games when, you know, people, a lot of people seeing you on national television, you know, then drop some then, just to, you know, capitalize as much as we can off that.
One of the stories locally is that of Dan Lambert. He's a local fan and a businessman. He wants to pay every UM player basically $500 a month. And, you know, part of that's going to be promoting his company. Are you taking that offer? I mean, or does it depend on the circumstances and what you're going to take?
I haven't fully seen the offer yet. I know it was offered to us, $500 a month for 6 months. Obviously, it's a big offer, you know, just for him to sponsor every single player on our team, every scholarship player on our team. That's huge. And I want to say that I think we're one of the first teams in, you know, college football history to get the whole team sponsored. And that's one of my big things. I want to try to get everybody as much money as possible, but I haven't fully seen, you know, the contract yet, so I don't know if I'm going to take it yet.
Now, you know, Lambert has gone on to say that he wants to help UM improve its recruiting. He wants to see UM back in the national title hunt. Look, every school can do this now, but I'm wondering from you. Let's imagine that. Let's say, as an example, I'm a young wide receiver, the most coveted wide receiver coming out of high school, and you want me to come to UM. So how are you going to sell Miami now, considering I could make money on my name, but I could do that in Gainesville or Tallahassee or Clemson or Alabama? What's going to be different? How will you recruit me in Miami and South Florida?
Well, no, first of all, I think Miami kind of sells itself. You know, Miami is one of the, you know, the best cities in America, right? And it's crazy because all the schools you just named, they're great schools, great academic schools, great sports teams, great football teams, great head coaches, all that. And I think the difference from Miami to those schools is that you're in the city of Miami. You know what I'm saying? Like, after college, I don't think many Alabama players are going to live in Tuscaloosa. I don't think many, you know, Clemson players are going to live in that town. But the city of Miami, you can live here forever. You know, you can raise a family in Miami. It's just a great city to be in. You have a lot of things you can do, a lot of ways to, you know, capitalize off your name and also play big-time Division I football with a city that loves the U. You know, they love the U more than anything, any other team in the city. So I think that's the selling point the coaches are trying to make.
We're talking with De'Eriq King, the quarterback for the University of Miami. King recently became one of the first collegiate athletes in Florida to make money off his name, image, and likeness. You can read more about the new Florida law allowing collegiate athletes to receive compensation by heading to our social media at WLRN Sundial. What has Coach Diaz said to the team about these new rules? Is he asking anything in particular of you, or is he just keeping hands off?
Coach Diaz is hands off. He wants us to go out there and, you know, capitalize as much as we can. But we all understand we have a very old team. We have a veteran team. A lot of people came back, and we all understand, like, you know, the main thing is still the main thing. It's still about playing football, still about playing well on Saturdays. And we have a kind of covenant within ourselves that this is not going to distract us from doing what we have to do, from lifting weights, watching films, going to class, you know, preparing for games the best way we can. So that's Coach Diaz's message. You know, go out there, make as much money as you can, as long as you're doing it the right way. You know, you have to send everything into compliance and still work our tails off every single day to be the best football team that we can be.
And I wonder what the university has said. Are they helping you, working with you, or have they said any rules as to what you can do? Like, for example, certain businesses they don't want you to be tied to, maybe like alcohol or anything like that?
Yeah, so every individual school has their own set of rules. I think for UM, their biggest rule is you can't do any adult entertainment. And, I mean, obviously you can't do any drugs. That's the only thing. And if you're above 21, you're allowed to do alcohol. So that's the main rules that we have. And UM has done a really amazing job the past 8 weeks, 9 weeks preparing us for this moment. You know, they kind of set everything in stone, and we just have to follow the plans. It's really laid out there for us to understand everything.
You know, the other thing I think about too is this, Derek, is that you're a student athlete. You gotta focus on school and football, and that's a lot. Most people can't balance the two. Now you're a businessman, you're an entrepreneur, you're selling your brand, and that's a lot of work. How are you gonna balance all these things?
Yeah. Oh, well, like I said, I think, you know, obviously school and football comes first before anything. And that's why I think the importance of having a good team behind you. Like literally my website that I have and the app that I'm co-founding and everything I have going on, I literally don't have to do anything. You know what I mean? So my biggest goal is to be the best, you know, quarterback, best football player I could be for this upcoming season. So school comes first and, you know, football second. And that's the thing. I don't have to. It's nothing. I don't think for me personally, it's going to be anything that I'm looking on my shoulder. Okay, dang, I got to go to this meeting. Or when football season comes, it's football season. Like that's my main focus.
You got to play 3 years of football before you can enter the NFL draft. You know, I see this one young player in Tennessee, freshman basketball player, signed a $2 million deal annually. $2 million. That's a college player. So I'm thinking to myself, and I'm wondering what your take on this. Let's say you got an athlete, a football player, after 3 years thinking about entering the NFL, and then their agent tells them or they find out, well, you're probably not going in the first round. Well, maybe I'll stick around another year because I can make $1 million, $2 million just playing college football.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that's the next step. Like, you're going to see guys doing this every single year, right? So when guys that have like a later projection or, you know, might not get drafted and they're making, you know, hundreds of thousands of dollars by playing college football, I think they'll decide to stay. And I think it's a pro because, you know, you get your degree, you know, you get to play, the university gets the players a little longer. So I think it's all, you know, benefits to this bill passing.
How many more deals are you working?
I have a few more on the table, but my biggest thing is, like, I mean, obviously you don't want to work with every brand, right? You don't want to work with every company. You want to go with the ones that make sense. I have, like I said, I have a good team behind me, and, you know, any company that reaches out to me, we like to do our research. So, you know, look up the company's core values, look up, like, what they stand for and, you know, how they treat their employees, like things like that. So I have a few more in the works that should be, you know, coming out pretty soon.
Tell us a little bit about some of those deals. I know you got one with The Wharf here as well. Tell me a little bit about, like, the deals that you have and what's expected of you.
For example, like the Wharf deal, it's... Honestly, it's not. I don't have to do a lot, you know, post on social media, you know, come do a little bit of appearances here and there. And it's like I said, it's really like whenever, you know, we both agreed for me to come. You know, Kyle Chunks is definitely, you know, post on social media, you know, put a story on my feed once a month, and you go live with the owners once a month. And that's pretty much it. So most of my deals are pretty much social media based and just me promoting the company.
You know, the other thing, too, I think about athletes is any merchandise that's sold, the universities and the NCAA make that money. But has there been any talks about, you know, starting your own clothing line or your own, you know, shoe line or something that way you could sell on your name that way?
Yeah. So I started my website, which has like a lot of merchandise, like hoodies and shirts and, you know, sweatpants like that. So that was the first step. And I'm looking to grow that. So I think the next step is, you know, getting more, maybe some baby clothes or, you know, more female clothes on the website. And I have a really good team behind that. They're, you know, we're in talks every day about that kind of stuff.
And that was University of Miami quarterback De'Eriq King, among the first collegiate athletes in Florida to make money off of his name, image, and likeness. You can find more on this story on our social media, WLRN Sundial, and let us know what you think. Is it the right time for college athletes to get paid? Should there be a limit on how much they can get paid or what companies they could sign up with? Stay in touch with us via the text club. Just join our Sundial text club and share your thoughts on that story and more. You can always find great opportunities to join the program that way and give us ideas as well. Just type the word hello to 786-677-0767. Again, the word hello to 786-677-0767. What are your thoughts? College athletes finally making money on their name and likeness. Well, that's our program for this Monday, July 12th. Coming up tomorrow on the show, Miami-Dade Mayor Daniela Levine-Cava is going to join us with an update on the search and recovery efforts in Surfside, Florida. We're going to learn how the catastrophe has changed her priorities in office and put a renewed focus on building safety in South Florida. Plus, a new investigation from the Palm Beach Post and ProPublica explores sugarcane burning in western Palm Beach County. It's been a part of the agriculture community for years, but Community leaders are concerned about the environmental and health impacts. That story and more coming up tomorrow on the program. Remember that you can always find more on the show. Just go to WLRN.org. You can also listen to the show again tonight at 8 or get the podcast. Just search WLRN Sundial on your podcast app. I'm Luis Hernandez. Thank you so much for listening. Stay safe. Be good to each other. We'll talk to you again tomorrow. The program is made possible in part by support from Miami Cancer Institute.